Welcome to Sound of Symphony, the unofficial symphony podcast. Hello, you're listening to the Sound of Symphony podcast. My name is Magnus Nordlander.
And I'm Tobias.
And we hope you'll enjoy our show. So first up, we thought we'd give you some news from the symphony world. Do you like news, Tobias?
I do love news. But should we say something about... Tell us a little bit more about the podcast and why we're doing this.
Yeah, sure. We're thinking this should be a monthly podcast where we basically try to give something to the community to listen to. Some news, some interviews.
And basically just have a discussion about symphony.
Exactly.
I mean, we usually have discussions just you and me. I mean, let's say we record them.
Yeah, we're thinking our discussions are so high quality
and so
that
interesting.
We'd like to share them with the world.
Definitely.
Right.
Yeah. Show us some news.
Yeah, sure. Did you know, Tobias, that Symphony 2.5 just got released?
Yes, I do. And it got released one day delayed, wasn't it?
That's true. It was only out on June 1st, I believe, which it is indeed one day too late.
I saw Fabienne blame it on packages.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He said there was some bug in packages, and he said it wasn't able to release 2.5.
Well, we'll have to talk to Jordi about that then. I suppose you're wondering what's new in Symphony 2.5?
Please tell me.
Well, because, you know, it is sort of difficult to find, actually, because you only get the release notes since the last release.
Yeah, so the release notes for 2.5 was just like two commits, wasn't it?
Exactly, because that's the difference between release candidate 1 and the actual release. But we've done the work here. We've actually compiled a few of the changes, and we're going to give you our take on them.
Okay, shoot.
So the first change that I'd like to point out is that there's been some form and invalidation improvements. So, for example, there's support for multiple file uploads, you know, from HTML5. And there's a bunch of new validators, like the strict email validator or the UUID validator. And the form debugger looks even better. And this is a great thing because I actually tried that out yesterday.
Okay.
I had an error in a form, and it's much, much easier to find out what's actually gone wrong from the form debugger.
Okay.
That's really nice, yeah.
That's hours of debugging from my part.
Really?
Yeah. I often got lost in form errors.
Yeah, but you'll enjoy the new debugger then.
Great. Do you know the differences between the strict email validator and the regular email validator?
In fact, I do.
You do, okay.
Yeah, I read in the commit that the previous email validator uses PHP's filter var.
Okay.
That apparently lets through a couple of email addresses, I don't know exactly what form, that aren't really supported by the email RFC. Uh-huh. So the strict email validator uses an extra library to provide even better validation for emails.
So it's basically, we should always use a strict email validator.
Well, I'm thinking, because emails are notoriously difficult to validate, there's really, really strange combinations that's actually valid.
Looks pretty simple. You take a string, an at sign, and then another string dot and top domain.
Well, what happens if you have another at or a space?
It's not valid.
No, yes, it is.
Is it?
Yes. Email addresses are notoriously difficult to validate, actually.
I never, ever encountered anyone having two at signs in their email address.
Oh, but it's entirely possible, as long okay. as you enclose the email address in quotes. That part of the email address, actually.
Okay.
So that's sort of...
So email addresses are tricky to validate.
Oh, yes. But usually, most people don't really try to have these really, really strange email addresses. And... what I think most people will find is that the main issue they'll be having with email validation is that people simply mistype their email address, and you can't really validate for that anyway.
I'm actually going to write a bundle to validate that.
Really?
Say that you write at gmail.com instead of com. I could find that typo and ask the user, are you sure this is a correct email?
That's definitely true, and that's probably a good thing. You should definitely write that bundle. But of course, if somebody mistypes in the first part of the email, for example, that's
pretty difficult to find.
Yeah, you can't really handle that, and that might actually be an existing account as well.
So you're not Magnus. That's not your email.
Yeah. So I think that's probably the most common form of email troubles, other than the really common ones like missing an at sign. So I'm thinking, unless you have some special requirements, you're probably good with the non-strict email validator, which is why that's default.
Mm.
But if you have some special requirements, you'll enjoy the strict email validator.
Okay, let's move on with the changes.
Yeah.
In Symfony 2.5.
Exactly. There's been some improvements in the translation component as well, including a translation debugger.
So great.
That shows you a list of the translations and the translation strings, what they're translated to, and the fallback for them. So you'll be able to see if their strings are untranslated and actually see what each translation string will be when you're done.
But you can see if strings are untranslated.
Yes, because
if you got multiple languages.
That's true, exactly. If you have multiple languages, you can see if you have translations for just one of those languages, for example. There's also a new debug command for Twi extensions.
Okay.
Which shows you which functions and filters and globals a Twi extension provides.
That's three new debuggers so far.
Oh, yes. There's a lot of debug help in this release. And I mean, another one is a better error message just for undefined methods. That's also debug help.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite part of this new release is that the standard edition has been cleaned up.
Finally.
Yes, finally it's been cleaned up. When you create a project using Composer Create Project, it'll ask you if you want to install the demo bundle. And you don't want to install the demo bundle unless you're a first-time user, in which case, fine, go ahead and install the demo bundle. But I don't have to anymore. It's marvelous.
Great. I actually created you say clean up and remove the demo bundle and remove the other stuff you don't really use.
Yes.
I actually created a Symfony version myself.
Oh, really?
Where I added a lot of stuff. I added my company bundles. I added the bundles I use a lot.
Yeah.
Like Doctrine migrations and fixtures and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So my Symfony version is fully packed with a lot of other stuff that I use.
That's ironic because I created a Symfony edition where I removed everything. It's basically the standard edition without all the stuff.
Okay.
But finally, I won't need that anymore because the standard edition is now cleaned up. So that's marvelous. You can now actually choose to use the Symfony 3 directory structure.
I haven't really seen that directory structure.
No, because it was sort of a quiet sleeper. It was in a PR in the standard edition. But what it does is that it moves all your binaries, for example, the console command, to a bin folder instead.
Okay.
And it moves stuff like caches into a var folder, so it's more closely resembles a common Unix directory structure.
Do I still got the app folder?
Yes, you still have the app folder, but it doesn't contain stuff like your cache directory anymore.
Okay. Because I saw a discussion on the GitHub, because the original thought about the app folder is that you can have multiple applications with the very same files.
Well, you still can if you'd like to.
Yeah, that's a feature of Symfony 2.
Yeah.
But I guess they've changed that with the new folder structure in Symfony 3.
No, it's still perfectly possible to have multiple app folders. And it's still, you'd still have your cache directories in the var directory, but you have multiple cache directories instead.
Okay, okay.
So yeah, that's still possible.
Oh. But then again, I don't think that is many of us using that feature.
No, I've used it on one project, but not really sure that it's... Well, it was probably a good idea to use it on that project. But
I mean, compared to just do a second Git clone.
Sure, but sometimes you want to share a lot of code, like most of the code, and in that case, you'd probably want to have the same... Yeah, it's. I mean, it is more of a fringe case now that we have Composer, But back in the days when you had to use like Git submodules or stuff like that, it was a mess. So it was much nicer to use one repository and multiple applications.
Okay.
But we can move on to other news, I'm thinking.
Yes.
Did you know that Sensio Labs Insight is out of beta?
Out of beta?
Yes.
Okay, no.
Previously it was in beta, but now it's out of beta.
Great.
Have you used it?
I have just had a brief look on it.
I have used it for one of my projects, and I gotta say that I like it.
Okay.
It does a lot of validation, some of which I didn't even know until I started using Sensio Labs Insights.
Like what?
Well, for example, if you're referring to resources, the most common way of handling that is by using the __dir__
yeah.
constants. yeah, it's a lovely name. Thank you, PHP developers. That's not actually the right way of doing it if you're using a Symfony bundle.
No, because it messes up bundle inheritance.
Exactly. So you have to use a method on the kernel interface, which is locate resource, I believe.
Yep.
And that's one of those checks that Sensio Labs Insights does in your code. I believe it's over 100 checks they're doing, and it doesn't really replace using, say, a test suite, but it does do a lot of useful static code validation. If your project is an open source project using Symfony, there really is no reason not to use Sensio Labs Insight, because it's free. If it's a closed source project, you'll have to pay, but it's really a useful tool actually.
I could say that the Sensio Labs generator bundle.
Yeah.
It doesn't use this new way to locate resources.
Really?
It uses the __dir constant.
Really?
Yeah. And I submitted a pull request like in January.
Yeah.
But I haven't got any response.
Well, maybe someone from Sensio Labs is listening to this podcast.
I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So you can't really extend the you can't really inherit from the generator bundle.
No, that's true.
To add your own skeleton.
That's true, and that's actually a reasonable thing that you'd want to do.
Yeah. Of course, you could do it to put your files in the app resources folder.
Yeah.
But you can't write your own bundle to do the very same thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Strange. Yeah. Well, the Spanish Symfony community held a conference on May 31st.
Yeah.
It's called the Symfony Day 2014. And it was in Barcelona. Have you ever been to Barcelona?
I haven't, actually.
Me neither. It looks like a lovely town, especially when there's a symphony conference there.
Yeah.
They filled it to capacity with 120 attendees, and there were 8 speakers and an unconference session.
Okay, great.
That probably would have been fun if I had spoken Spanish.
Was it all Spanish?
Yes, it was all Spanish.
Oh, okay.
The latest versions of PHP are breaking backwards compatibility because of the serialization format.
Yeah, I read a tweet about that as well.
Yeah.
Was it who discovered it? Was it?
I don't know who actually discovered it, but it's causing some issues in Doctrine if you're using entities which implement the serializable interface.
And also the FOSS serializer bundle.
Oh, really? Yeah. I'm not surprised, but it's quite a problem. They fixed it in Doctrine in master, but it's not been implemented in 2.4 or 2.3 at the time of.
But was the latest version of PHP 5.5.12?
I believe that's right. Yes.
Okay.
So hold off on updating until you can update Doctrine if you're using it. And this could also affect it could also affect your code if you store serialized objects in your database, even if you're not using Doctrine. I actually went out on the web and took a look at some of the commonly used bundles for Symfony.
Okay.
To see if there's been any new releases, and would you know it? There has been. FOSS REST bundle just released 1.4.0 release candidate 1.
Okay. What's the changes?
Well, the big new feature in 1.4.0 basically seems to be array normalizers. Array normalizers allows you to transform the data after it's been decoded in order to facilitate its processing. So say, for example, that your REST API wants to use camel case for identifiers. but you don't use camel case in your project. You use snake case or whatever. Now you can write a array normalizer, which changes your keys to snake case, to camel case instead of snake case. And you still keep your code using whatever standard you'd like, and you can have an API which has a different standard.
Okay. That seems like a nice feature, but is it really necessary if you're writing your own API?
Well, not if you're writing your own API and you just can control the entire API.
Right.
But sometimes you're actually implementing a previously standardized API.
Okay.
And in that case, it could be quite useful.
Okay. Yeah. I'm convinced.
Yep. Nelmia API doc bundle was updated to 2.5.2, which includes bug fixes, mostly for, among others, for full 2.5 compatibility. And
I use Nelmo API doc bundle.
Yeah.
And I really like it.
Yeah.
But I haven't submitted the feature request. It seems pretty weird to tell you in this podcast here.
Yeah.
But what if you want to have two doc pages, one for the free users and one for the premium users? And you can't really say that this very API function should be for the premium users only. In Nelmo API doc bundle, you can just have one doc page and that's it.
Yeah.
I'm not expecting you to have the answer.
I don't
here.
Have an answer. I can tell you right now, I don't have the answer to this question.
I will submit a feature request.
Yeah. It might also be somewhat out of scope. That's a possibility. In that case, you probably should be able to solve it using bundle inheritance in some way, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So.
But I imagine it's not an unusual use case.
It's probably not, but it's definitely not as common as having just one API, I'm guessing.
Not true.
There's also been numerous new bug fix releases for this is a bit of a tongue wrestler, HWI OAuth bundle.
I haven't seen that bundle.
It's one of the most common bundles, actually.
Okay.
But there was three new bug fix releases during May, so way to go, ST Lloyd.
But tell me about the bundle. What does it do?
I don't know.
It's one of the most used, you said.
It is, but I don't use it. It's for OAuth.
Oh.
So I just took the most commonly used bundles from KNP bundles. So that's basically. I don't use either of these bundles, actually.
No. I use the rest of the Nelmo one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's basically it for the news from the Symfony world. There's been nothing else happening.
Great. We got that covered.
Yeah.
Should we move on to the next section of this podcast?
I think we should. I thought this would be an excellent thing to do on the podcast. Symfony has a lot of features. It has so many features that there's probably quite a few hidden gems that you might not know about.
There's a lot of hidden gems.
Yeah.
And I don't say I know them all, no. But I know some.
Yeah. But maybe our listeners don't know them all either.
It could be a good thing to recap as well.
Exactly. So I'm thinking I'm going to tell you about a hidden gem in Symfony. And hopefully the listeners will like it.
Can you say hidden gem without making that face?
No, I have to make that face when I say hidden gem.
Okay. Well, what's your hidden gem?
A couple of years, I read a blog post from GitHub. Because they have their nice blog where you can find out about their features. And they had this post about what they call the mission control bar, which has it's really similar to the Symfony debug toolbar. It's on GitHub. But what they do is that they have their own metrics, as well as metrics like how long time did this page take to render, which is, of course, available in the debug toolbar. They also have metrics like how often did we have to access the Git repositories, and are there any jobs in the queue? And the hidden gem that I'd like to bring to the table here is that you can actually do this in Symfony as well, because you can define your own debug toolbar data collectors and templates. So you can handle this for your application to have application-specific metrics.
Okay, and it's not just a stopwatch.
No, it's not just the stopwatch, but that's available as well, of course. But you can use the data collector API to get whatever data you'd like, actually, and present it how you'd like in the debug toolbar.
Could you give me some example of that of a data you might collect,
might
want to collect?
Sure. As I said in the GitHub example, they collect how often they have to access the Git repositories, which is quite useful. There are of course numerous examples through the existing bundles. Like Doctrine uses it to print out how many SQL calls you've done.
Yeah, but that all, except for the standard ones.
Yeah.
I mean, say in my typical application, what kind of metrics do I possibly want to collect?
Well, in your typical application, it really depends on the application.
It's very domain specific.
There's no right answer, and it is very domain specific.
Okay.
And that's sort of the point, because the standard metrics are there already, and they're great, but sometimes you can have more interesting metrics that are domain specific.
Okay. So how do I do if I want to find some specific metrics to measure?
Well, if you want to find specific metrics...
How do I do if I want to collect some specific metrics?
Well, you need two parts. First of all, you need a data collector class. And there's an interface for it, and there's also a base class available, so you don't have to do the heavy lifting.
Okay.
Which you implement, which collects data from somewhere and stores it in the internal data array. You register that as a service, and there's a tag for it. And then, in order to display this in the debug toolbar, there's the web profiler template that you'll also need. And using the web profiler template, you're able to define either in the toolbar, you can have a small space there to show whatever you like, or if you have lots of info, you can actually take up an entire page in the web profiler, so you get your own section in the profiler, and you can just put out tons of data. But usually you'd need a third part as well, and that's some sort of a logger service. So for example, say you're logging HTTP calls. You don't actually want to get the data collector service and log into that, because that has to be serialized. So you want to keep that lean. So instead, you create a logger service, which is then injected into the data collector. And the data collector actually fetches data from the logger service and edits that into the data array.
Okay. That's kind of sweet. I actually came up with a use case.
Yeah.
I mean, in my application, I do a lot of API calls.
Yeah.
And it's a good way to measure how many API calls I'm doing in each request.
It sure is, but...
But?
You're probably using like Buzz or Guzzle or something?
Nope.
Oh, okay. Well, then it's a good case.
Great.
And the data collector collects the data from the logger and stores it in the profiler data, which is in your cache directory by default.
Mm.
And when you're viewing the web profiler, it deserializes that data, and you actually have access to everything from the data array in your profiler template.
Great. Is there a cookbook entry for this?
There is. It's called How to Create a Custom Data Collector.
Great. Should we put a link in the podcast show notes?
Yes, definitely.
Right. Great.
So that's my hidden gem.
Great.
Do you have anything you'd like to talk about, Tobias?
Yeah, I want to bring up the issue of testing. I mean, it touches your subject as well.
Yeah.
But I recently encountered, isn't there any best practices for testing? I mean, how do I do if I want to test my repository?
That's an excellent question.
I mean, in the documentation, it says that you should do functional testing.
Yeah.
But functional testing doesn't really cover all my test cases. And there are inputs to the repository functions that are not covered by the function tests.
They can also be kind of a hassle to write.
Yeah. So, and I listened to a talk by... Casper Guena?
Yeah, Casper Gunia, yeah.
Casper Gunia. And he talked about BHAT and BBD.
Yeah.
And BDD testing.
BDD, yeah.
And I mean, that's another way of testing stuff. And you get the unit test and you get the function test. I mean, how should you test if you want to make sure your application runs properly?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I mean, I'm looking for best practices. I found a lot of interesting articles on the internet.
Yeah.
According to testing of Symfony 2, but I haven't really seen most articles are like, you should do like this to speed up your testing. If you do like this, you empty the doctoring cache, and if you do like this, you, I mean, it's just small hacks to improve your testing.
Yeah.
But we don't get a proper testing framework, or do we? I mean, how do you usually test your applications, or do you test your applications?
I usually just test the most important parts that are easily testable. I don't usually have 100% test coverage.
Okay.
Yeah.
the way I do it, for my key transactions,
yeah,
for like the login and the apply for a job,
yeah,
I use functional testing.
We should add that your application is a recruitment platform. So
yes, sorry.
Yeah.
I'm building a recruitment platform.
Yeah.
So for key transactions, I'm using functional tests.
Yeah.
And to make sure to make sure you fill in the forms and everything like that.
Yeah.
And then for important functions like calculate test results or calculate this or do that, I use unit testing because that's a good thing. But I'm still, I feel that my application isn't tested enough. I mean, I got like 40 or 45% test coverage.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like more half the application is not tested. What if I remove a property of my entity class and it breaks some code like every on random places? I'm not too sure what I want to come with this statement.
Well, no, and it doesn't sound like you have a solution in line to tell.
No, sorry. I want to raise the issue.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's you raised. no.
I think I'm reaching out to our hundreds of listeners.
Yeah.
To please give me an article, give an example, an article that you're using and that describes how the test processes should be like.
Yeah, but I want to add something though, something that our listeners might be able to use. When you're writing your test cases, if you're writing functional tests, you can actually use data collectors to test metrics. So you can, for example, collect how many queries have I run, which is what Doctrine does,
mm-hmm.
and you can actually check the results from that from the profiler in your tests.
If you are doing functional tests.
Exactly, if you're doing functional testing.
You can't really do it if you want to test repositories.
No, that's very true. So for testing repositories, that's not really useful. But for functional tests, it is.
Like I said, it's a lot of neat little hacks, but no best practices.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So if you want to do something spectacular to the Symfony community, please provide this testing framework.
Yeah. Cool. Well, you know, we have a special treat for your listeners here.
Yeah, we do.
We have a guest interview. And this episode's guest is, I'd call him the Alex Trebek of the Symfony community.
No, but he's a true celebrity.
Yeah. Well, he handles our Jeopardy sessions, and he also has some pretty awesome presentations. Let's listen to our interview with Jeremy Mikola.
And with us here, we got Jeremy Mikola.
Yep. Jeremy works at MongoDB, and welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
So perhaps we can begin by you telling us about yourself.
That's a very open-ended question.
Well, yeah, that's true. Let's start with, what do you do?
Okay, so I just crossed my 2-year anniversary with MongoDB, working on the PHP driver and Doctrine ODM and all the any related open source project that I can make an excuse to work on. And I work alongside Hannes Magnussen from Iceland and Derek Rithens, Dutch, but he's living in London, so we're all very distributed. And previously, I was making web applications at OpenSky and Exercise.com, which gave me my introduction into the Symfony community. And so that takes me back about 4 or 5 years and got me started working on Symfony 2 before I had even touched MongoDB.
Right. Let's go back a little bit further, though, to the beginning of your developer career, so to speak. How did you get started programming?
I would have to go back to, let's see, like many, getting an Apple II computer back when I was in primary school and playing through... what is it? Oregon Trail and a bunch of those other. So my first introduction was gaming, and then remember going to computer shows and getting shareware CDs of Wolfenstein 3D and Doom and all that stuff, and then playing QBasic and playing the Gorillaz game or Nibbles, and then looking at some of the source code, and then the getting started in the I guess mid to late 90s. I ran a SimCity fan website at the time, so I had to get started with it was called. News Pro or something like that with some CGI script to run a news blog, and then I ended up at some point using PHP Nuke, and then later making my own backend for it, and that was about when I was in high school, and then come around college time, going to college around 2001, and I started making my own blog and wrote the whole backend for that, and so that was my make my own framework experience, which I still have the code today. It's fun to go back and look back on.
Yeah, I've done that a couple of times too. Look back at my old code. But for me, it's mostly a mix of nostalgia and horror.
But there's a certain elegance to it.
I've done that a couple of times as well, but I feel embarrassed.
Yeah, me too, sort of. I wouldn't want to share that code with anyone.
Nah, I'm trying to hide it. I just delete it. I don't want to see it anymore. That's probably what we're going to think of the code right today, if you look back on it from 5 years from now.
Granted, it was all procedural, but one of the two things I really liked about it was that I used PHP files as templates. So even long before I knew anything about controllers and model view controller stuff, I had like separate template files, and then I had the backend file that would then go render the PHP template. And then the other thing I had was an image gallery, because I had a Wacom tablet. I used to do a lot of, like, I drew my avatar that I use on Twitter, so I have a lot of like old cartooning hobbying that I've done. And I had a separate controller that would generate thumbnails, and I knew I couldn't do this in one PHP script because it takes too much memory or it would run too long and get timed out. So I had a web request, the main page would make web requests, and each PHP file would get loaded, would render the and cache the thumbnail. And this was like kind of when I was just starting college. I really had no experience with web programming. I kind of look back fondly on that code.
I guess maybe it's not all bad then. But if you don't mind, I'd like to follow up a little bit what you said earlier. You said you were working with Symfony 2 4 or 5 years ago. That must have been very early in the beta stages.
And yes, very much beta, very early. And it was one of the earliest discussions I remember at OpenSky was debating whether we would make our own form component because there was not a Symfony form component yet. And thankfully, we decided to wait and... Bernard got some stuff published, and we did that instead of going our own way. But we were already using the rest of the framework at the time.
That's pretty cool that you dared to use such new technology for the project. But personally, did you start using Symfony 2, or was Symfony 1 your gateway into the Symfony world, so to speak?
So it was actually Symfony 1. So I mentioned I was in college from 01 to 05, and my senior year of college, our capstone project was making a Game Boy. We made a GPS program for Game Boy, so it was some C programming. And I thought that was fantastic. So when I graduated, I went into defense contracting to go work with assembly. That was a nightmare. Stayed there remarkably for 2 years. And after I'd forgotten most of my high-level programming knowledge and went back to school doing research for a year, and that was working in mostly Python. And then after that, so the whole time I'd been doing this, I had been writing PHP on the side for, in college and stuff for blogging things, but I never did it professionally. And so after, it was 3 years out of college, and after the research position, I wanted to get like an actual full-time job, something that paid nicely. And a company took a chance on me, even though I had no experience. So I went to go work for Interactive Corp in Manhattan, which is a big umbrella bunch of companies. And they had it was a corporation that owned a startup. So it felt really, really startup-y, but we also had like a retirement plan and stuff. So it was kind of a weird environment. But they were using Symfony 1 with Propel 1 at the time. So that was my first introduction to actually using... I had played a little bit with CakePHP before then in some client projects. And I was sold on Cake because they had a shiny website. But yeah, yeah, both of those were my first. Yeah, yeah, it was. See, right now, like Symphony 2's website is in much better shape, but the cake just had those nice illustrations. I mean,
yeah, I remember that. The cake website looked good.
Yeah, it was quite convincing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoyed all of it until I was querying for database objects and they all come back as arrays and I would run out of memory and have to upgrade the PHP memory limits to make the site work. But yeah, Symphony 1 was my first exposure to web frameworks, really.
So you definitely been using Symphony for a while then. As I understand, while you were doing Symphony 2, you also started working on Doctrine MongoDB. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, certainly. So while at OpenSky, as we were moving from Magento to Symphony 2, so the Magento was all SQL-based, and the data model was kind of like, I guess, how maybe WordPress does it with EAV tables, so the entity attribute value stuff. And so you had your main product. It was an e-commerce, OpenSky's e-commerce website. You have your main product, and then you had the arbitrary attributes, which would be a separate table of keys and values. And this was total. I mean, Magento seems to be a bit better shape today, but at the time it was totally not scalable at all for what they were trying to do with it. They had too many storefronts and too many products indexed. And so they had decided to use, at that time, MongoDB's New York office was across the street from OpenSky. So how great is that? They could just walk across the street and ask questions. It was like the best support contract ever. And so there was good camaraderie between the two companies. And they decided to pick up, at that time, I think it was Mongo 2.0, and there was no real PHP integration. And so Bulat, who now, I think, recently started at DataStax, but he was at Twilio for a while between OpenSky. So he and John Wage had gotten involved, and that this time, this is quite a while before John Wage was working for OpenSky, where he still is now. And they had started on, I think John independently started on doing a Doctrine port for MongoDB. And this, that was the first ODM, and it was based on the Doctrine ORM2 had just come out like a year or two before, so they had the common interfaces already established for doing like with the unit of work and all that stuff. And so Bulat had gotten involved with that, and they were basically working. That was how Bulat spent most of his open source time. I was much more involved in the Symphony contributions. And then eventually John came to work at OpenSky, and then at Mongo, like we were, like I guess patient zero for testing MongoDB ODM, and so they've still been using it. And John, as John stated, OpenSky, he had a lot more job responsibilities leading a team in Nashville, and so I ended up getting more involved with Doctrine ODM. I ended up going to exercise.com after, which was like the same technology stack, and so I was there for 8 months between OpenSky and MongoDB, and then coming to MongoDB officially, it was. They kind of hired Derek Hannes and I around the same time, so previously there was no PHP team. And so Derek Hannes had tons of PHP extension experience to take over the driver, and I would be learning that under their like kind of mentorship. But another part of my job responsibility was, oh, we'd like you to still work on Doctrine ODM. So I no longer had to make excuses to do open source stuff at work. I could just do this full time now. It's wonderful. And then, like since then, it's been 2 years. I still haven't been able to publish a stable ODM release. feel so bad about that. The equivalent of DBAL, the Doctrine MongoDB library on its own, that I've gotten into shape. But the ODM still has a ways to go. And so I kind of have to donate maybe like 1 week a month to sort through pull requests. And John Wage is less accessible in that respect, so it doesn't get all the love that it needs. But we've come a long way on the actual PHP driver and the underlying Doctrine MongoDB library. So, and that takes us to today. So I still kind of spend my time juggling between those two projects for most of it, in addition to all the conference stuff.
Yeah, speaking about conferences. Magnus told me earlier that you were hosting the Symphony Jeopardy session. Can you tell us something about that?
So let's see. Symphony Jeopardy, I think, started in on Twitter, I believe, while I was at OpenSky, which is the... So after this company, after I was at Interactive Corp, I went to work for OpenSky. And that's when we were using... they were just moving from... They decided to use Symphony 2, coming off of Magento. And I don't know how I got when I was using Symphony 1, I wasn't intimately involved in the community. I think I had maybe a few track issues open to my name, but I really had no real contact with anyone. And so Symphony 2, kind of like onboarded, I became a core contributor because there was so much work to be done. And so I started interacting with people on Twitter. And one of the things I've always done at all my companies is kind of goof off and make people laugh. And I've kind of continued that in the at the conference arena with the lightning talks and things. And so there's actually some my coworkers at OpenSky had novelty accounts in my name. And that's how I can go back and find these tweets, because they actually retweeted a bunch of these things. But I started a Symphony 2 Jeopardy hashtag, and I would just pretend to be the host on Twitter, and people would just interact with people that would follow the hashtag. And this was also, I guess we were in the Symphony dev chat back then, which was a lot more active 4 years ago. And so that's where I kind of met everyone and was able to easily find them on Twitter and everything. So I definitely credit that with getting involved in the community. I think without that core contributor, I wouldn't have been.
Are you still doing the Jeopardy sessions?
Yes. So the most recent one we did was at SymphonyCon in Warsaw. And God willing, I'll be able to go out to Madrid later this year. Even if they don't get a talk, I've told numerous people that SymphonyCon is something that I would shell out money to go for, even if I can't get travel covered by work or whatnot. Just to see everybody.
Yeah.
And so I definitely plan to do that, because there needs to be lightning talk, Jeopardy, and karaoke. So even if those are the three essential things, and I'm pretty sure no one at Sensio really cares what I present at. They basically just want those three things on the community schedule, which I'm perfectly okay with.
Yeah, I mean, it has basically become a symphony tradition.
Yes. Yeah, and I've tried to do... We did Jeopardy at Sunshine PHP. It's not quite the same. I mean, you can't do as many inside jokes when you have, like, a cross-community conference.
No, that's definitely not the same. I mean, if I were to go to, say, PHP Benelux or one of the other big conferences, there's not that many people I would know there. I mean, I would know some people, but it's not the same as going to, say, SymphonyCon or Symphony Live.
But guys, what do you say to someone like me? I've never been to any symphony conference. Wouldn't I be an outsider?
Well, I mean, no, I don't think so. Not really. The way I look at it, there's basically two kinds of conference goers. There's those people who's there to learn, and they go to all the sessions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then there's people who basically goes to the sessions to hang out with their conference buddies.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and there's certainly overlap, but the conferences, so within the last year, I've been going to more U.S. conferences. I haven't had as many opportunities to go to European conferences. But there's the regular people that I bump into, and some of them, there's obviously the folks that go as speakers, which is super convenient because you can go to a lot more things without having to pay. But then there's people that just go as attendees and even don't really care about, maybe they'll go see one or two sessions, but they're really there for networking and to meet people in person that they've otherwise interacted with on Twitter. And so there's always what people refer to it as like the hallway track. So they're not there really for the sessions, but in the hallway, that's where all the conversations are going on, or they would love to do like the Uncon sessions or the Birds of a Feather sessions. Some conferences have those. And so there's the official conference schedule, and then there's the people that go and make their own schedule. And really, if you're going and you know one, so like Tobias, if you were going and Magnus was also going, just hang along him and he's going to probably lead you into the after parties and
exactly
all the crowds to meet new people.
Yeah, into the karaoke stages and whatnot.
Yes, it would be difficult, I guess, if you were going and you didn't know anyone there at all. I think a lot of us are kind of introverted. I know I'd definitely be in an unknown situation. Definitely be introverted and would be averse to meeting new people. So it's nice that it's convenient for me that people can walk up to me and say, "Hey, I've seen you on Twitter before," and that's my I don't have to introduce myself. But there is a level of social awkwardness, which I think as developers, we all may be more inclined to this.
Yeah, but that's where things like the Jeopardy session or going to a karaoke bar really helps, I think.
Yeah, I think especially with karaoke, there's people that would otherwise be sitting around in the hotel and not have anything to do. Another thing that, so recently at Lone Star PHP, so Dustin Whittle, I see him, he's more in a dev evangelist role, his company AppDynamics. So we've been seeing each other at conferences and usually we'd like to go out to dinner. When I was at Lone Star, we wanted to go out to dinner and it was just going to be a small crowd where it would be me, him, and two other friends. And then a bunch of other people at the Lone Star conference kind of were expecting that I would organize this after, well, it's after the conference. Let's all get a bunch of people and go out to dinner. So I was like, all right, Dustin, well, people want to go out to dinner, so I'll bite the bullet and do some uncomfortable thing where we have to split checks and try and get a reservation for 12, 13 people. But that's a role I'm happy to play. Because in the end, I can go out, next time I'm in San Francisco or something, I can just go see Dustin. But how many people that just come, this is their only conference and they'd like something to do afterwards. So I kind of, at least now, kind of feel obligated to take on that role.
Yeah, you kind of become the community organizer at the conferences. Not that I'm complaining, because you do it really well. But you also give some pretty cool presentations. Do you have anything in the pipeline presentation-wise?
But yeah, I feel like I have to put effort into staying relevant in the Symphony community, other than just being like the court jester, because I'm totally riding coattails of all the contributions I made way back when. So I'm have to keep on top of my game. One of the challenges that I personally face is I don't feel like the conference talks that I submit are substantial enough, especially every time I hear one of like Igor Wiedler's presentations on Turing machines or some wild stuff. And so I really want to, and maybe this is like a year out, but really come up with some interesting stuff to present next year. And maybe some of that will be like in the last couple of months, I've been working on an HHVM driver for MongoDB.
Yeah, I read your blog post about it.
Yes, so we had Facebook has a Open Academy class. So the blog post was actually I attended a Facebook event. I still have to make a blog post for the actual to summarize the project results. But we had 7 interns from university. Some of them were in their senior year. Some of them were a bit younger. Basically, taking course credit to work about 5-10 hours a week on a prototype. So they were allowed to pick the project. I kind of proposed some ideas. And so we developed an HHVM extension in C++ and PHP. And it was really more of a research project. Over the next 6 months, Hannes, Derek, and I hope to kind of clean up the PHP driver quite a bit and be able to move a lot of it into pure PHP, which is something we learned doing the HHVM driver, where you write as much as you want in C++ and the rest can be PHP. So we learned what are the things that need to be in C++, what are the things that we can get by having them in PHP. And so obviously the C++ for HHVM is going to look much different than the C for actual Peckle driver, but ideally we can share as much PHP code as possible. And then have much smaller core drivers that just do the no frills, just like connections in the querying. So we're definitely looking for, so that's something I hope maybe by eight or nine months from now, I'll have like a very interesting story to present at a conference about that.
That sounds pretty cool. I'd probably watch that presentation at a conference. So now, one last question before we let you go here. Will we see you in Madrid, Jeremy?
I totally believe so. I'm waiting for the call for papers to open. And once I have all the dates confirmed, I'll probably just go ahead and book the flights anyway. Yep. But I just have to make sure the scheduling all works out and make sure there's nothing going on here that I need to be present at.
Well, who would book something to go at the same time as SymphonyCon?
Well, so I don't know. But next week we have a driver summit in the MongoDB New York office that I had to be here for. So I had to pass on a trip to Bangladesh. Which would have been a nice covered trip. I'd been there 2 years before. There's certain obligations that I still have professionally that I can't just drop everything and go to conferences all day. But May has been a...
But you're the one running the Jeopardy session.
I know. There's a total obligation for me to be there. But I would totally just fly in for one evening to do that and leave.
Yeah. Well, it's been nice talking to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish you guys, it seems like a good first episode. I think you guys are off to a good start here.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for inviting me.
Wasn't that great?
Lovely fella.
Yeah. For our next segment on the show, we'd like to tell you a little bit about what happens in the community, what's up and coming in the community. And... Well, as you probably heard in the interview, I really enjoy going to conferences, and I thought we should do some sort of a rundown of what's coming up.
Yeah, you should try to lure me into the conference going.
Well, let's see if I can do that. First up, there's the Sensio Labs conferences.
Yeah.
I'm sure you already know about them.
I know about them, but yep. Tell me more.
There's the Sensio Labs Symphony Live in London. It's September 25th to 26th. The call for paper just ended, so I'm thinking we should probably be getting information about speakers pretty soon.
Yeah, and hopefully my name is on that list.
You've entered into the conference?
No, I've submitted a call for paper.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Cool. So, hopefully your name will be on the list.
Crossing my fingers.
Yeah. There's an early bird price, which ends August 1st, and that's £160.
Okay.
So, I actually went to Symphony Live London last year.
And how was it?
It was fun.
Was it any good topics?
Did
you learn something?
Yeah, I definitely enjoyed the session about integrating Drupal into Symphony by Fabrice from Theodo. All in all, it was a really fun conference.
Okay.
Yeah. But of course, these are the Symphony Live conferences, which are regional. So basically, the Sensio Labs, the Symphony Live London conference targets the United Kingdom mostly. Just like our next conference here, Symphony Live Berlin, targets Germany and the German-speaking world.
So that's the difference between Symphony Live and Symphony Con.
Exactly.
Symphony Con is more global.
That is the huge worldwide conference that targets everyone.
And how many attendees is it in the live in the Symphony Live?
I don't have those numbers actually.
It's like 100 people, 200 people.
I don't know how many people, but there's definitely more than 100 people.
Oh.
I'm guessing like 200.
Oh.
And
could you give an estimate on the Symphony Con? How many? Is it thousands of people?
No, there's not thousands of people. If I recall correctly, it was around 600 people last year.
Okay.
And that was, of course, the first Symphony Con. But that's a pretty good turnout.
Mm-hmm. Great. What about Berlin? When is Berlin?
Berlin is October 29th to 31st. And this is a German-speaking conference. The call for papers is open until August 1st. And they've already announced some speakers.
Okay.
Fabienne will be there. Bernard Schussek and Lucas Covey-Smith will also be there. As will Benjamin Eberlei and David Silke.
Who's Benjamin?
Benjamin Eberlei works on Doctrine.
Okay.
So he's basically the go-to guy for Doctrine ORM.
Okay, I didn't know.
Yeah. The early bird price is €129, but that's including VAT. But this is a German-speaking conference, so...
You should read up on your German before you go.
Exactly. and then, of course, there's the conference of the year, basically. The big... This is the event of the year, Symphony Con Madrid. there hasn't really been much information about Symphony Con yet. A newsletter sent out by Sensio Labs revealed that it will be in November, but there's not much else known. So we'll definitely be staying on top of this one. I'm definitely going.
No matter what.
No matter what, I'm definitely going.
Okay.
this is the event of the year, basically.
Okay, great.
This is what we're all building towards. That's it for the Sensio Labs conferences. Then there's actually some third-party conferences as well. For example, there's something called DevCamp in Paris, which is June 30th to July 6th. And that's a week-long camp for students and young developers arranged by the Diocese of Paris. And that's targeted towards newcomers to Symphony. And I actually think that's kind of cool. I didn't really associate the Catholic Church with programming camps.
No, that's quite rare.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it in Sweden anywhere.
No, we don't really have much of a Catholic Church in Sweden.
we don't have any programming activities in our churches.
Not that we know of.
Not that I know of, nope.
But this is a really cool initiative because, of course, we need more developers. And it's a week-long conference. It was really cheap as well.
Mm.
So... I mean, if you live in the Paris area, it is, of course, in French. But if you're an interested developer, you should definitely go there. And it'll allow you to learn Symphony, and it's probably a lot of fun. Speaking of fun, there's also the PHP Summer Camp in Ravenge, Croatia. on September 3rd to September 6th. And it's arranged by the EC Publish guys, but it has a big symphony focus. It's basically a... the way I'm imagining this is that it's basically in a big resort hotel with a spa and stuff like that, and it's by the beach.
Any place in Croatia is by the beach.
That's probably true. I haven't been to Croatia, actually. but then there's many speakers already announced, like Ryan Weaver and Bernard Šušek and Derek Rithens. The program is actually up on their site, so there's many interesting sessions, and they're at different skill levels. I actually thought some of these sessions look really interesting. And it concludes with a boat trip in the Mediterranean Sea.
The Croatians really know how to sell the conference.
Yeah.
Spa resort, by the beach, yeah. And the boat trip.
Yeah.
Everything included, right?
I hope so, because the early bird price is $360.
Oh,
the early bird price is 360 euros.
Oh, gee.
But that does not include accommodations,
of course.
And then there's another conference which we feel especially strongly about.
I would say this is the event of the year.
No, that's still Symphony Camp.
Ah, sorry.
But it's November Camp by Symphony Sweden.
Both Magnus and I are in the board in Symphony Sweden.
Yeah, so while you should take our word for this, we are somewhat biased. but we had a November camp last year, and that was a lot of fun. And
yeah, we got like 80 attendees. We got 8 speakers from 4 different countries.
Yep.
And it was sure a lot of fun, and I actually learned stuff.
Yep.
And I hope you did as well.
I actually did. And this year, we're hoping to make it even better.
Yeah.
Because we're targeting not just Sweden this time, but all of the Nordics. So we're really hoping this could be sort of like a regional conference for all the Nordics. And it's bigger. We have more seats to fill.
It is in central Stockholm. All our sessions will be in English.
Yeah.
And we have recently opened the call for papers.
Yeah.
So if you're interested in visiting Stockholm, you should definitely go to symphony.se.
You should. And we will, in fact, be able to cover your travel expenses if you travel from Europe.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we'd only be able to make a contribution to your travel expenses. So that's pretty cool as well. And that's basically it for this podcast, I think.
Yes, it was a good hour to speak to you, Magnus.
Yeah. This episode of Sound of Symphony is coming to an end. The show is written and produced by me, Magnus Nordlander, and Tobias Nyholm.
Yeah, you should visit our website, soundofsymphony.com. And don't forget to send us some feedback, because we love to hear from you. And you should tell us what we've done good and what we've done bad.
Yep. Thanks to our guest, Jeremy Mikola, and to our sponsors, Fervo, which is my company, and Happier, which is Tobias' company. Fervo is a symphony consulting business, and Happier develops a symphony-based recruitment platform.
Our music, Cool Intro and Cool Vibes, is provided by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com. And it is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you, Kevin.
Yep, and Symphony is a registered trademark of Fabian Potencier in the European Union and other countries. This podcast is not endorsed or sponsored by nor affiliated with Fabian Potencier.
Yeah, we're back next month with more of Sound of Symphony.
Yep, thanks.